dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has been a freedom fighter in that war for, well, decades now, in a variety of important capacities, is our first guest. She is Elizabeth Yore. She is best known as an attorney and an international child rights advocate who has founded and leads a wonderful group called Yore Children. That's Y-O-R-E. Children. She has worked for Oprah Winfrey as an attorney. She has been a general counsel in the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services. She has been active on a number of human rights fronts, including international trafficking, as well as child abuse, and most recently, and perhaps particularly importantly, leading the fight under the banner of something called End FGM Now, the practice of female genital mutilation, a horror that is inflicted on women and some girls in many places around the world, but incredibly, it's legal in 11 states of the United States as well, something Liz Yore is trying to fix. Liz, thank you so much. We talked with you recently, but I wanted to double back on this topic and several others, and thank you so much for finding some time for us. One of the things that I think is really important to set the stage for this conversation about your work and at End FGM today is the sheer scale of the problem. Give us an estimate of what the number of women and children in this country who may be at risk of this practice known as FGM amounts to.
Yes, thank you. Center for Disease Control did a study back in 2015, an updated study, which is now almost 5 years old, and they found that over 513,000 women and girls in the United States are at serious risk for female genital mutilation. That number continues to rise exponentially in the United States when they first started tracking it in about 1996. And it's a shocking statistic. It is hard to believe that this heinous, ancient, barbaric practice is going on in the United States, you know, in the 21st century. Yet we recognize that it is. And the only way to counteract it is with tough, strong criminal laws, both on the state and federal level, that will send a strong message to the communities that are practicing this barbaric practice to stop, or else face, you know, serious criminal consequences.
Liz, just very quickly, because this is a bit of a complicated story, but there was a federal statute on the books prohibiting this nationwide. What happened to that?
That's correct, Frank. In January of 2018, a federal judge in Detroit struck down the constitutionality of the female genital mutilation statute that had been passed and on the books since 1996. I felt very strongly that this was a constitutionally sound statute. Now it has gone back to Congress for reworking consistent with the judge's decision. But at the moment, there is no federal protection for this heinous practice of FGM. Essentially, the United States is on the same level as Sudan and Chad, other countries, third world countries that do not have protection for female genital mutilation violations. And so what we have been forced to do, and I think very successfully, but not completely yet, is go to the states to ensure that all the states have female genital mutilation criminal laws on the books. And when we started, Frank, I think there were some outstanding 26 or so states that did not have laws on the books. Now we're down to only 11 states remaining that have not criminalized FGM.
This is to your great credit, among others, Liz Yore, and I want to thank you for that work. And also talk a little bit about one of the states at the moment, as we discussed earlier in the week, that has been very problematic in this regard, the state of Maine. Liz, talk a little bit about why it is that the state of Maine has not got a prohibition on FGM on its books at this moment.
It really is shocking, Frank, because FGM is, as we say, a bipartisan issue. We have seen that through many states. It's a male and female issue that legislators feel very strong, except for the state of Maine. And the person who is leading the charge to strike down any kind of legislation is shockingly a feminist, the Speaker of the Maine House, Sarah Gideon, who also happens to be running against Senator Susan Collins for the Senate spot in Maine. And Sarah Gideon has, on a number of occasions, led the fight with her Democratic colleagues in the House legislature to not pass this bill. And it has been defeated a narrow margin on a largely partisan basis, with Republicans overwhelmingly supporting the bill to criminalize FGM in the state of Maine, and led by Sarah Gideon, the Democrats fighting off any challenge in defeating this bill. I mean, this frankly is shocking, because you know she claims that she is a feminist, and you know, Frank, this statute, like domestic violence statutes in the late 1980s and 90s, like human trafficking statutes, these laws protect women. And that is what, and children. And this is why we have been fighting so hard to get this legislation in place in every single one of the 50 states.
So very quickly, Liz Yore, why is Sarah Gideon so adamantly opposed to enacting protections for women and girls in the state of Maine, of whom there may be, I assume, if there are 500,000 plus nationwide, maybe several thousand at risk up there? It just doesn't compute. Is there some explanation for it?
Well, Sarah Gideon's explanation, Frank, is that it's a racist bill towards the Maine Somali immigrant community. You know, Somalian women undergo 97% to 98% in Somalia undergo this horrible procedure and practice. They import it into the United States when they come to the United States. And, you know, I think, you know, very strongly, and we had victims of FGM testify before Sarah Gideon and the legislature. An FGM victim by the name of F.A. Cole said that Sarah Gideon, quote, did everything in her power just to kill this bill. And this woman pleaded with the legislators to pass this bill. She knows, F.A. knows the trauma, the pain, suffering for a generation, for her entire life.
Liz, I really want to salute you for the work you've been doing on this and urge Senator Susan Collins to challenge her opponent on this very important topic, because it's vital that we have in the United States Senate people who will ensure at the federal level that this is fixed, as well as at the state level. We'll be right back with much more with Elizabeth Yore of Yore Children right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for a second segment, I'm very pleased to say, with Elizabeth Yore, a remarkable advocate for, well, human rights in general, but particularly for women and children's rights. We were talking about her great work on countering this scourge of female genital mutilation. She's also a very devout Catholic and has been at the forefront of efforts to try to get the Pope, the man who is the putative leader of the Roman Catholic faith and an important figure in the international faith community writ large, to stand up for, well, human rights of, in particular, people of the Catholic faith and, for that matter, other faith communities. Liz, again, thank you for taking some time and giving generously of it at that. I wanted to just ask you about this agreement, this secret agreement that was signed by Pope Francis with the Chinese Communist Party that has given rise to some kind of understanding between the Church and the CCP that seems just unimaginably unacceptable for the faith community in general and Catholics in particular. Talk a little bit about it, if you would.
Yes, on September 22nd, 2018, the Vatican signed a secret agreement with the CCP, allegedly some kind of agreement that there would be a mutual selection of bishops, both by the CCP and the Vatican. Well, no one ever saw the real terms of the agreement, but the actual and real impact of this agreement has been a huge increase and uptick of Christian and Uyghur and all sorts of persecution by religious communities in China, and the entire religious freedom community of NGOs and organizations are in agreement, Frank, that the Vatican triggered a huge increase and uptick in religious persecution by signing this agreement and keeping it secret. There have been an onslaught, Frank, of letters and petitions and submissions, both to the State Department, to the Vatican, to the UN, regarding this outrageous agreement that has caused untold suffering. We have bishops and priests that are being arrested and detained and sent to labor camps. We know what's happening to Uyghurs, all as a result of this agreement that nobody has ever seen. So there has not been a sense of unity, which the Vatican said that they wanted to achieve by signing this agreement, but there has been an uptick in persecution against all faith groups.
Let me make sure I understand, Liz. The Pope agreed, and the terms are unclear, but the practical effect has been that the Chinese Communist Party now appoints clergy for leadership positions in the Catholic faith in China. And that has had the practical effect, if I understand you correctly, of legitimating the Chinese Communist Party and its oppression of religion more generally, not just the Catholics or Christians for that matter, but Uyghurs and other faith communities as well. And the thing that's taking place is it's not just that they're incarcerating some of the clergy that the Chinese Communist Party has not actually installed, but they're desecrating churches, they're destroying some of them, they're persecuting people who are in underground churches trying to practice their faith. Talk a little bit about what the Church is now being subjected to in terms of changes to the faith itself, Liz, by the Communist Party of China.
Frank, we have seen literally a demolition derby of churches, crucifixes, all religious symbols, not only in churches, which is heinous enough, but also in homes where they go in and strip the home of any religious icons. Additionally, Frank, which is extremely troubling, in these churches, they replace the crucifix, the pictures of saints and Jesus Christ, with the picture of President Xi. He is the new idol that is now ordered by all the people of China to worship. Again, what we have also seen, and this happened just before the Vatican signed this agreement, which in my mind should have been a deal breaker. The Chinese Communist Party passed a very onerous religious regulation stating that all children under the age of 18 are not allowed to worship in any religious ceremony, services, education. And so as a result, has literally wiped out the practice of religion in the next upcoming generation. And yet the Vatican, Frank, signed the agreement knowing that this was on the books. And as a result of this, there has been onerous persecution on children and families who are desperately trying to get their children to have some kind of religious experience and practice the faith. Additionally, we have seen the roundup of priests and nuns who have been running orphanages of disabled Chinese children, orphans who have nobody. The state is closing down these orphanages, throwing the priests and nuns into jail. It is unimaginable the amount, and yet, Frank, the most heinous thing is that there has been absolute silence from the Vatican over this persecution, not only in China of religious faith, but also the persecution now going on in Hong Kong. The Pope has remained absolutely mum.
Well, in a way, if I understand this correctly, it's worse than mum. He's apparently now involved in negotiations to renew this secret deal. Is that right, Liz Yor? And is it likely that the terms are going to be different from the ones that he accepted with all of these, you know, disastrous effects, do you think?
Frank, we don't know. Yes, there are all indications that this horrible agreement is going to be renewed. I think there's all indications that it will remain silent and secret. Additionally, the Vatican has been the biggest booster and cheerleader for the Chinese government by saying, quote unquote, this is out of the Vatican, that the Chinese Communist Party has done a wonderful job in containing the virus. Can you imagine that? That the Chinese government has been operating a terrific program of organ donors. You know, it is unimaginable that the moral voice of the Holy See has been usurped by the Chinese Communist Party. I think this is just the beginning. I think we're going to see additional support. I think this fall we're going to see additional things such as supporting the work of the Chinese communist government in, you know, frankly, spreading the China virus. We're going to see an onslaught of an attack on the Trump administration and also a promotion of socialism as an economic model for all countries to follow.
Liz, this is stunning and really shocking, as you say. And again, I appreciate so much your putting a Klieg light on it. I know there's a letter that you've signed, as have I, being circulated by the International Religious Freedom Roundtable at the moment, expressing the profound plea to the Pope not to do this any further and to mend his ways. I hope this will get very broadly supported and be heard loud and clear by the Vatican. If it is, I know it will be in part thanks to your leadership on this, and it's so appreciated. Let me turn to one other thing that you've also been leading on, Liz. You've brought your legal skills to bear on behalf of those who believe, as I certainly do, that the Chinese Communist Party, well, in some of the ways you've already mentioned, but great many more, is actually legally something that we should be designating and sanctioning as a transnational criminal organization. Talk about that and the implications were we to see Attorney General Bill Barr make such a designation.
Well, Frank, you know, the administration has been carefully and systematically laying out a case in my mind, which really justifies the labeling of the CCP as a transnational criminal organization, a TCO is what it's called. This is an executive order that was passed, which provides a designation, for example, for violent transnational organizations such as Hezbollah and others, to be charged under RICO and additional criminal sanctions. It also provides the U.S. government for going after companies that are supporting the CCP. Because once it's designated as a transnational criminal organization, much like the mafia, much like drug cartels, as we know, legitimate businesses cannot do business with a transnational criminal organization without serious legal implications for their own business. So it is, I think, absolutely critically important. Now, if you go through the fentanyl epidemic in the United States and the 30,000 or more Americans that are killed from fentanyl, which is generated directly out of China, manufactured and sent by the Chinese virus. And now we're also seeing, Frank, from China, gun parts and the hundreds of thousands being shipped into the United States as well, unfortunately being intercepted. But we're not intercepting all of them. So this is a soup-to-nuts criminal organization that has targeted the United States. The government and this administration has been very carefully setting forth this foundation. For example, with the piracy in internet piracy and in patent theft and infringement. So on all criminal fields and all criminal levels, the CCP is nothing short of a transnational criminal organization. We need to treat it like that.
Thank you so much for this report on your work and your great contribution you're making through your children. I hope you'll keep us updated on both the FGM front and what's happening with the Vatican and this TCO business. Thank you again, Liz York. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with David Goldman. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for one of our signal contributions from our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, that of David Goldman, a Renaissance man who goes by the name of Spengler in his essays, many of them really quite brilliant, at Asia Times. He has, under his own name, however, published most recently a terrific new book, You Will Be Assimilated, about China's efforts to Sinoform the world. He is generous with his time. We're always very grateful for it and delighted to welcome him back. David, thank you for joining us today. Let me talk with you first and foremost about a report out of the Financial Times today, I believe, describing the wild success that Hong Kong is now having as a financial market with the imminent initial public offering of a major Chinese conglomerate called Ant Group. It's described as a tale of two cities. The actual state of affairs in Hong Kong for people outside of the financial community seems not so good, but I'd be interested in your take on this report, and more to the point, what's happening there in that beautiful city that once was one of the jewels of the free world?
Well, chasing Chinese companies out of the American stock markets had a kind of briar patch effect where the wet real estate in Hong Kong, as a result of which there have been enormous capital flows into Hong Kong. Hong Kong dollar has been extremely strong. American institutions, the major American brokerage houses, are looking to earn massive fees on some of the biggest IPOs in history. Now, Ant Financial has 900 million customers. It not only does your payments, but it integrates your stock market, your bank account, into your small business credit line. It basically uses China's big brother, big data approach to knowing everything about you to make vast amounts of loans. And it's gradually replacing the traditional Chinese banking system, which is bureaucratic and stupid and inefficient and full of bad debt. So this was a force founded by Jack Ma, the creator of Alibaba, China's answer to Amazon plus Google. And it's about to have the biggest IPO in history of about $40 billion dwarfing the previous record, which was Ramco. So everyone is trying to get into this. Chinese stocks have been extremely strong. The room for value added in terms of improving efficiency, for example, in payments and micro-lending that Financial represents, is extensive. So the whole financial world is battling at Hong Kong, completely ignoring the trampling of human rights and the disappointment of hopes for democracy in Hong Kong.
And the challenge, I guess, is, are they going to be, as a result of ignoring, well, among other things, warnings from the United States government that investing in Chinese stocks is a bad idea, that they're actually enabling much of the problems that we're seeing from China, which is really maybe a financial problem for some, but certainly a national security problem for all of us. And you've talked about the ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party in your book, You Will Be Assimilated. It does seem as though we're going to have a come to Jesus here, if I can use that expression, with these financial mavens in Wall Street who are, yes, making fortunes for themselves, but doing so at the national expense.
The U.S. government has been deeply ambiguous on this. As you recall, one of the principal demands that President Trump made in the trade negotiations with China over the last couple of years has been to open the Chinese market for American goods and services. And one area where the Chinese really have thrown open the gates is the financial markets. They want U.S. financial firms. They want BlackRock to teach them how to run mutual funds. They want Citibank to teach them market making, custody, and bank functions, because their own banks are really a dog's breakfast. So U.S. financial firms are contributing extensively to Chinese efficiency, and the Chinese can say, we're simply doing what President Trump demanded we do, which is fair play for American firms and giving them the chance to make money in China. So until the United States government is a very clear idea of what it wants American firms to do, they'll do what President Trump basically told them to do. That's the dilemma we have.
David Goldman, let me ask you about another piece of this. You sort of touched on it, and that was the idea of reciprocity as a principle in our dealings with the Chinese Communist Party. There are new restrictions that have just been announced by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that essentially bring an end to favorable treatment that Chinese diplomats had in this country, to align it more with the kind of treatment that American diplomats are subjected to in China. That, I think, must be seen as a fair response to the restrictions that the Chinese are imposing, don't you?
I certainly think it's a fair response, Frank, but we're talking about symbolic issues. This is not going to change the balance of power between us and China.
But it is a principle, though, David, and I'm asking basically about the idea that for a long time, and this is not unique to this particular thing, I just want to point out quickly, you know, we also have this bizarre situation where we've allowed the Chinese actually to have preferential access to our capital markets, another place where the reciprocity is not operating.
Yeah, well, that reciprocity is, in fact, being established, as we were just discussing, and we may not like the outcome. You can also say that whereas Chinese are allowed to set up Confucius Institutes all over the United States, the Chinese would not allow us to go to China and set up Lincoln Institutes all over China. So, you know, there are a lot of issues that we could call them out on.
You mentioned earlier to me off air, David, something that I did want to ask you about. Another part of the Chinese enterprise that is worrying is, as again you've documented in the new book, its very aggressive pursuit of dominance in various high-tech, arguably decisive technology sectors. Talk about what we've just learned about China lashing up with the Russians to do technology development that almost certainly will be dual use in character, I should think.
The Russian economy is like a creature of the gigantic head and a spindly body. They graduate more engineers each year than we do, and Russian engineers are extremely good. Their industrial organization has always been catastrophic. The head of Huawei, its founder, Mr. Ren, just announced that since China is being subject to all kinds of technology controls by the United States, they are massively increasing their R&D in Russia. They're going to try to harness that human capital to China's technology designs. We also know, of course, that they've hired thousands of chip engineers from Taiwan, which is the great center now for chip manufacturing. And computer chips, as your listeners know, are the building blocks of the digital economy. They run everything. So China is responding to our attempts to slow them down by restricting access of companies like Huawei to American chips by massively building up their own industry. And they're doing that by hiring the people who know how to do it. We can stop them from buying chips, but we can't stop them from hiring anybody who will work for them. And they're paying double pay to to nominees' chip engineers. There's never been a case in history where technology restrictions have worked out for very long. And that's what worries me.
Well, it is worrying, and most especially if for all of those countries, whether it's Taiwan most immediately, presumably, or Russia in due course, or us, for that matter, these arrangements ultimately conduce to the creation of a Borg, as we've discussed before, that is going to ultimately consume those countries. It's a train wreck that is absolutely predictable. David, let me ask you about one other thing. It's a little bit out of area, but because you are a Renaissance man, I wanted to just touch base with you on it. The Pentagon recently announced that the Chinese are going to double the size of their nuclear arsenal, the number of warheads at least, from, wait for it, 200 warheads to presumably something approximating 400 warheads. And I just want to ask you, one of the things that has been a stupefying factoid, I think, to a lot of us, trying to study up what the Chinese are doing in terms of their massive military buildup across the board, is that they've invested in 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels that are associated with the People's Liberation Army and presumably concealing, among other things, nuclear forces. It seems inconceivable to me that the Chinese could still have only about 200 warheads, or even 400 for that matter, having made that kind of investment, infrastructure in which to deploy and, as I say, conceal what they've got.
I agree with you. I would assume that China's nuclear arsenal is a multiple of 200. Sufficient to frighten the United States with the possibility of a massive retaliatory strike. China's defense posture is designed to make it impossible for the United States successfully to fight a war. So they have a huge number of surface-to-ship missiles that can control the seas around its coast at a range of 800 miles. That basically makes it's very hard for American carriers to get it close enough to the F-35s to have effect. They've invested in a very large fleet of very quiet diesel electric submarines, which, of course, could sink American ships. They have satellite killer missiles. They've had them for nearly 15 years, which means that if a war broke out, the first thing that would happen is all American satellites would be either destroyed or perhaps blinded by powerful ground lasers.
You put all this together, though, David, my own feeling about it is that this is actually a war-fighting capability, not just meant to deter the United States, and that it actually has in mind offensive preemptive capabilities, not just a retaliatory capability. We're going to talk more about this with you on another occasion soon, if we may. David, we're out of time for today, but thank you for covering this broad waterfront with us, as always, in a stimulating, thoughtful way. We'll look forward to doing so next week. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles about, China, what it's up to, and also what's happening domestically that ought to be of concern to all of us as well. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're going to pick up on some of the themes we were just discussing with David Goldman with another of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. I'm very pleased to say his name is Robert Charles. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State under George W. Bush. He is an attorney by training, having worked in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, as well as an accomplished author, notably of myriad op-eds and other articles at Fox News and the Association of Mature American Citizens, of which he is a spokesman. You can find his work there at amac.us, and also a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens. Bobby Charles, it's good to have you back. As always, welcome. I wanted to pick up on something that you wrote about concerning China a month or so ago, I guess it is now, Bobby. And it has to do with not just China, but with Joe Biden and China. You started out with this paragraph, which I just want to read in its entirety. Communist China's attacks with intent and indifference on human rights, humanity at large, and America are eye-popping and legion. They've become so numerous, regular, and stealthy denied with brash disregard for truth, that we risk growing numb to China's strangulation of Western values. Worse, Joe Biden appears captured by the Chinese dragon, and that is a worry. Bobby, that very succinctly describes both a huge challenge we're facing and a worrying problem with the Joe Biden candidacy. Walk us through your thinking on what's in prospect here and its implications.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Frank, China is on the ballot this year, and people don't think about it. We're thinking about, and the media writes a great deal about the economy, about COVID, about rule of law, all of which are important and are also in some ways on the ballot. But China is that great looming issue right in the middle of all of our lives that we really don't want to talk about. And it is significant because Biden really is captured, I think, by the notion that it's the same way that people pre-Reagan looked at the Soviet Union. The notion, and yet this is much more dangerous, I think, than the Soviet Union in many ways. There was a sense that we had to accept the legitimacy of this foreign hegemonic, brutal communist government, and somehow we would either converge with them or they would be a normal participant in our daily lives. Ronald Reagan said, no, we're going to call a spade. That's an evil empire. There's no legitimacy to its government. It's dominating its neighbors. It's dominating others around the world. And we're not going to let that happen. That's exactly what Donald Trump has said about China. And so the line is very stark in many ways. It's a clear, clean line. Those that vote for Trump obviously are voting for someone that's going to call China out on everything from human rights in Hong Kong and Taiwan to religious persecution, the economic manipulation on the global stage, and of course the militarization and gradual capture of everything from foreign ports to foreign economies to foreign countries and their sovereignty. Never mind the invasions of our sovereignty on everything from the stock market to our laptops, cell phones. China has a long-term mission, and their mission is dominance, and their mission, and they're doing it on a military side. We could spend all day on that. But I think that the distinction I would make is just so crystal clear. Indeed, Joe Biden has made this distinction for us by flying over with his son, squaring a deal worth billions for his interests. At the same time, I mean, there's corruption in that too, but at the same time, he was captured. He was sitting as the vice president, he was captured. And so that remains only stronger today. He's lost, I think, some of his steps. He has a vice presidential candidate who would go with the wind and seems to be pro-socialist in the quiet of the night. She pivoted immediately to defunding the police and things that she said she didn't believe before. So China is probably just licking their chops. I mean, this would be the best of all worlds for them if a Biden-Harris ticket emerged, which again is why China is on the ballot, and the president absolutely is right to call them out.
Well, one of the things that you said that I just want to clarify is, unfortunately, as in the era of the Soviet Union and Ronald Reagan, the challenge he faced in a major course correction, which Donald Trump is now undertaking in our time vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party, is it wasn't just that we had to sort of acclimate ourselves and tolerate the adversary. In both cases, I think you had large numbers of people, certainly in the elites, certainly in the business community, who thought their success, their ultimate triumph was inevitable, and we simply needed to cut the best deal we could to whether through detente, as they called it then, or engagement, as it's called now, try to make some sort of modus vivendi, as they say, a kind of a separate peace with them. That's what's so worrying, and that's what is on the ballot, it seems to me, is do you want that kind of inevitable decline of the United States and submission to a dangerous totalitarian system? Or do you want, as Ronald Reagan did in the past and Donald Trump is doing, I think, today, to preserve American sovereignty and security and strength and not acquiesce in this this nightmare of a world dominated by the CCP?
Now, you're absolutely right, Frank. There is no room to accept the legitimacy of that government. That government has in its sights all of the Western values and the Western governments one by one. I mean, you can just see the way they're moving in on Southern Europe, the way they're moving in on Africa, and picking off countries even in South and Central America with their, you know, I guess we could spend all day on it. But the bottom line is you are absolutely right. And this government has in sights that government, Chinese government, communist government, has in its sight an acquisition, if you will, of the Western world. And we need to understand that Reagan's approach to this, which Trump is following, is absolutely right. You have to say there is no legitimacy to this kind of brutal and also economic domination. There is no legitimacy to a government that aims to take over the world.
I couldn't agree more. This is one of the reasons why we value so much your participation in our Committee on the Present Danger of China, Bobby Charles, because that's the kind of clarity that is needed now. Let me just, we won't have time to do justice to this, Bobby, but one other piece that you've written about at the Association for Mature American Citizens website, amac.us, is something that I thought was a very interesting analogy. One other piece of what the Chinese Communist Party, I think, is trying to effect is supporting, if not actually enabling, those who are trying to take our country down from within. And you talked about socialism's fire arc. Give us a quick synopsis of your thought in that piece and its implications for our domestic situation.
Well, just to be clear, everybody from the Attorney General, William Barr, to some of the state leadership has pulled out, recognized that there are very explicit Marxist groups tied to a lot of the instability around the country. While it's hit roughly 200 cities and the National Guard has been called out in 15 states and 25 cities, the notion of a fire arc is very simple. Anybody who's been a firefighter or reads about it or knows about it has heard of the idea of backdraft. And what happens is that a fire burns in a contained environment and then it explodes. And when it explodes, because it doesn't have oxygen, it pulls everything in around it, all the oxygen, et cetera. And so what I see transpiring in these cities is little contained environments where they're running out of oxygen. And so where are they going to fire arc to? The fire arc logically moves into the suburbs and it moves into other cities and other locales. And it does, and it, frankly, there's nothing that stops. I mean, this is the point in the analogy is that this is how many socialist / communist revolutions begin. They begin small, and the Bolsheviks were a minority. They were not the majority, and they begin small, and then they begin to feed on themselves. They create this kind of chaos that people step back from because they're either intimidated or they're just generally afraid to interact. And this again comes back to the ballot this November, Frank. I mean, there's a president who represents rule of law, and there's a candidate who seems willing to be hands off. We can't afford hands off right now.
Amen to that. Bobby Charles, we have to leave it at that, though, for the moment. Thank you very much for your time today, as always, and the great work you do at amac.us, as well as your extended and very, very highly regarded service to our country over the years. Come back to us next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.